Tuesday night market season kicks into gear, KSVY and Sonoma TV have been hard at work updating the community calendar at SonomaValleyEvents.com to help you discover what's happening around the valley. Need inspiration for your next night out? Looking for live music, local culture, or family-friendly fun? Visit KSVY.org and click Sonoma Valley Events on our website header and let the good times roll.
The following show is brought to you in part by
Hannah Center's 2026 Summer Camps in Sonoma Valley. They are now accepting registrations. Week-long sessions include traditional camp activities along with programs in Lego robotics, creative arts, culinary arts, and other hands-on learning experiences. Campers have access to Hannah Center sports fields, swimming pool, recreation center, and multi-purpose spaces. Financial assistance is available for qualifying families. More information is available at hannahcenter.org/camps. That's hannacenter.org/camps.
Welcome to this week's edition of Deconstructing Media with your host, Ben Boyce. And I'm here with a weekly current events program, which is dedicated to cultivating deep media literacy and exploring the vibrant online independent news and commentary space. And my standard disclaimer is that the responsibility for the content of the show is solely that of the host. I am appreciative to KSVY for giving me the opportunity to be one of the voices of the Valley, so I hope to make our time together educational and hopefully entertaining. The educational part I can guarantee. So I wanted to start out today with my state of play today, which is some more sort of the intersection of psychology and the news. And, you know, I'm dismayed because it's pretty clear that these continual false dawns in the war of Iran keep going back to this set point of war. And I'm continually being reinforced in my opinion that the lethality and destructiveness of modern warfare is just as we finally had to kind of come to some kind of universal or global agreement or understanding that using nukes is the last resort because it's a suicide pact. Everybody's going to go down. But that has left the window open to, you know, so-called conventional warfare, which I thought, you know, World War I and II might have cured us of as a species. But nope, our appetite for that seems to be undimmed, at least in the reactionary quarters, which is where this stuff inevitably and always comes from. So it's in the case of the war in Iran, I think it's a Pyrrhic victory on Trump's part because if they continue tanking the world's petroleum reserves to critical levels and sky, you know, every inflation and prices skyrocket. That's not going to help him politically. And, you know, I don't think they're as concerned about that in Israel, because they regard this project as existential. But at some point, I keep hoping that Trump will listen to his pragmatic instincts and pull the cord and declare victory and leave. The longer we stay, the worse it gets. So that's my prayer for peace there, and way above my pay grade at this point. But what I can talk about with some certainty and some enthusiasm is the continuing reverberations of these extraordinary wins by the DSA-backed candidates across the country. The next big marquee event on the election calendar is a Senate seat in Michigan, and there's a really excellent candidate, Abdul Al-Sayed, who is running against an AIPAC-backed Democrat, Haley Stevens, and it's looking pretty good because Dr. El-Sayed is a formidable person. He's got a doctorate in public health. He trained as a he has an MD as well, and has held important executive positions. So he knows how to do a job like being a senator. He ran for governor, so he's been tested too. That certainly is an issue. So we're all training our sights on the Michigan race, and I send money, and hopefully I send money to support organizers in the state who are really going hard for this, because it could be the difference between control of the Senate or continuing, you know, the executive goes unchecked for another couple years, which at this point it seems like a frightening prospect, because if there were any guardrails, they're on the backside of us now. And so it would be good to have some perch from which to put up a stand here. But that leads me to sort of what is the philosophy that's driving these big progressive wins in there was a trifecta, Mamdani's three picks in New York City all got onto it, and all of them, you know, against a pretty established candidate. So it was a big night. It was a seismic night. One of the effects of it, of course, is that there's been a furious counter-reaction by the conservative Democrats, the people who call themselves the Problem Solvers Caucus, you know, the people that never solve a problem, but they still have a caucus. And these are primarily, to be blunt, corporate Democrats. They get most of their funding from corporations and AIPAC, and I think it's genuine for them. That's how they what they believe, how they were raised, and that's what they're going to do. But we have the choice to find someone who actually shares our values, who wants to see a more just and fair society, who wants to basically evolve past this dismal level at which we have now arrived. As a kind of a dispirited and deflating civilization. And we have lots of good examples in our past where, you know, the Republic hit, ran onto the shoals, ran aground. And we were able to, through collective effort, get the ship floating. But the same people kept taking over the control at the stern. So that's probably, you know, we're kind of realizing that's the next step. We're not going to change a lot of these people who are invested in the current distribution of power and wealth. We're going to have to replace them. And that's no easy task, particularly in an America in which the money has become virtually unlimited. There's the right can spend, there's always money in that banana shack for whatever they need to do. And so we're going to have to learn how to run candidates and candidacies that appeal to broad principles. So I'm going to try to get through, it's probably ambitious of me to get through my edit of this article, but I wanted to read an article by one of my favorite scholars and historians, Harvey J. Kay, who is the Rosenberg Professor Emeritus of Democracy Studies at the University of Wisconsin in Green Bay, and is the author of a great book, which I've heard him speak on a number of occasions, The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. And critical to this was FDR's fundamental understanding, which I think he got from his association with the socialists who were in his government, is that economic security is fundamental to democracy. And so in this article, Harvey Kay is trying to make the case that the socialist movement doesn't have to reinvent the wheel. In fact, given the amount of propaganda and negative word clouds that have been collected around the word like socialism for, as a propaganda technique for the last 80 some years. We've been through a Red Scare, which has made that harder. And so, if you can start talking about restoring the vision of FDR, which is the title of this article, We Can Still Realize FDR's Vision, that is a better sell than, do you want to adopt some foreign ideology that you don't really know that much about? And what does it mean? Do I have to share my toothbrush, or what does socialism mean? I think appealing to this FDR vision of the four freedoms and an economic bill of rights is essentially what he tried to introduce in his fourth and final term. And we were not so fortunate to have him live through that term, because I think it would have been a very different world. So here we go. Quote, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt delivered the greatest, most radical, and most profoundly democratic State of the Union address in American history on January 11th, 1944. Rooting his message in the revolutionary promise of the Declaration of Independence, with its commitment to fundamental equality and the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, FDR articulated the aspiration of generations, including our own, by projecting nothing less than the vision of a social democratic United States. No president has delivered a more compelling and lasting vision of transformational change than the one outlined by FDR in what was boldly described as a call for a second Bill of Rights. To ensure that all Americans would hear the message, he delivered it that evening via radio in a live fireside chat from the White House. FDR began with an extended review of the war effort, with an emphasis on what still needed to be done to defeat Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. Then, however, he looked ahead to the post-war moment, well aware that most Americans remained anxious about the possible return of the Depression. He declared, "It is our duty now to begin to lay the plans and to determine the strategy for the winning of a lasting peace and the establishment of an American standard of living higher than ever before known. We cannot be content if some fraction of our people is ill-fed, ill-clothed, ill-housed, and insecure. Evoking the spirit of the founders, he observed, "This republic had its beginning and grew to its present strength under the protection of certain inalienable political rights. They were our rights to life and liberty." He continued, "As our nation is growing in size and stature, however, as our industrial economy has expanded, these political rights proved inadequate to assure us equality in the pursuit of happiness. As a consequence, we have come to a clear realization of the fact that true individual freedom cannot exist without economic security and independence." The quote says, "Necessitous men are not free men. People who are hungry and out of a job are the stuff of which dictatorships are made." Echoing Thomas Jefferson's language in the opening of the Declaration of Independence, FDR continued, "In our day, these economic truths have become accepted as self-evident. We have accepted, so to speak, a second Bill of Rights, under which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established for all, regardless of station, race, or creed." The 32nd president then proceeded to call for an economic Bill of Rights that at its heart would guarantee to all Americans a useful job at a living wage, universal health care, a good education, food security, a decent home, and opportunities for recreation. In his first presidential campaign in 1932, Hay had outlined an economic Declaration of Rights to challenge the persistent Gilded Age order. He pointed in the same direction in his final 1941 State of the Union address, in which he proclaimed the four freedoms that would become the nation's declared war aims: freedom of speech and worship, and freedom from want and fear. FDR had little doubt that the majority of Americans, especially working-class Americans, wanted the freedom that extends from economic security. Roosevelt and his progressive coalition of trade unionists, progressives, and socialists battled reactionary forces at home during the Great Depression and then battled fascism abroad during World War II. In so doing, the people had radically transformed the nation and themselves. They had established the social security system, vastly expanded the nation's public infrastructure, and began serious efforts to protect the environment. Given all that they had achieved and were continuing to achieve, working people might well have imagined that something like an economic Bill of Rights was within reach. While it is true that they might not have used the term social democracy, neither did FDR, they certainly hoped for more of it. Supermajorities supporting expanding Social Security and unemployment insurance, health care for all, aid for all students, new public works projects, and a federal job guarantee. In the wake of the 1944 State of the Union broadcast, the AFL-CIO, as well as the National Farmers Union and leading progressive groups and celebrities, began campaigning not merely to re-elect FDR in the fall of that year, but also to promote his proposed economic Bill of Rights. The same forces that had fought the New Deal and FDR every step of the way still retained major influence over the economy and the politics of the country. Speaking for his class, Alfred P. Sloan, the chairman of General Motors, said at war's end, quote, "It took 14 years to rid this country of prohibition. It's going to take a good while to rid the country of the New Deal, but sooner or later the axe falls and we get the change." End quote. And with conservative Republicans, reactionary Southern Democrats, and especially corporate bosses in mind, FDR warned of a fierce, quote, rightist reaction late in his State of the Union speech. He also announced with a ferocity that should speak loudly to us today that after 50 years of class war from above, if such reaction should develop, it is certain that even though we shall have conquered our enemies on the battlefields abroad, we shall have yielded to the spirit of fascism here at home. FDR won re-election in the November of 1944 by a landslide, but he passed away the following April, just months into his fourth term. Yet the vision he championed did not die. Progressives and labor and civil rights movements sustained it for years. FDR's call was echoed in the Democratic Party platform of 1960, and the great labor and civil rights leader A. Philip Randolph's proposed freedom budget of 1965, and in the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s work on behalf of economic justice in the final months of his life. U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders resurrected FDR's language and vision as a touchstone for his 2016 and 2020 presidential campaigns. Yes, Sanders lost, but polling by Data for Progress in 2023 showed that, just like our parents and grandparents, the great majority of us do want an economic Bill of Rights. That call is now being raised by a new generation of congressional and statehouse candidates across the country. In this 250th year of our American experiment, and as we begin to approach the 100th anniversary of Franklin Roosevelt's transformative presidency, we have an opportunity to redeem the promise of the Declaration of Independence and the best of the spirit of 76. This is the time to fight for and finally secure an economic Bill of Rights for all Americans, end quote. So I say here, I second that message, Franklin, and I'll get to break and be back shortly.
You've been listening to Deconstructing Media with your host, Ben Boyce, sponsored by
Hannah Center's 2026 Summer Camps in Sonoma Valley. They are now accepting registrations. Week-long sessions include traditional camp activities and programs in Lego robotic, creative arts, culinary arts, and other hands-on learning experiences. More information is available at hannahcenter.org/camps. That's hannacenter.org/camps.
It's summertime. What better time to enjoy live music? Your Sonoma hometown band will present a free concert, Picnic in the Plaza, on Saturday, July 18th at 1 o'clock in the Grinstead Amphitheater. The band will perform beloved classic songs and contemporary favorites. Bring a picnic and enjoy a lunchtime concert. For more information, sonomahometownband.org.
Now back to Deconstructing Media.
All right. And we're back with following up on those stirring words. And I found myself, 100 years later, yearning, close to 100 years later, yearning for... Can we ever finish that job? Can we ever finish that? I hope so. That seems to be, the issue that that most preoccupies us here. And there has been, of course, like a backlash, which was not to be. That's not unexpected, but it has created. A barrier for people who are trying to resurrect this vision. And one of the things that they've run into, and this frankly worries me a little bit, is there seems to be a collusion between the conservative Democrats and members of and people on the in the Republican Party, who would very much, I think, like to be able to, you know, restart some kind of red purge. And that's very much a concern, because it's within my historical memory, the people who initially taught me the ABCs of socialism and the culture of a socialist cadre were older guys who had lived through the Red Scare. In fact, where I lived in Arizona, the Red Scare was still a thing. You know, you had to sign, you couldn't get a job as a school teacher if you didn't sign an anti-communist oath. And the little steady group that I would, as a precocious teen, young teen, I'd just kind of hang around the edges and listen to the old heads from this this committee of correspondents. This is a group of socialists and pacifists and anarchists who had come together to protect a school teacher who's a Quaker, whose religion forbids him to take oath to anything other than God. And so it was a, you know, that was a test case that they were running. That was current in my youth. You know, twice in our history, the left has been virtually exterminated. It was like an Indian tribe that got run into the hills. After World War I, Woodrow Wilson used the wartime buildup to crush the socialist movement, who was opposed to what they regarded as a dumb imperial war. And so, and they were right, you know. And I think at the, you know, some of the young kids, I don't think fully appreciate just how recent some of these, you know, deep troubles have been. And that I'm very aware this can come back and it can haunt us again. But in the midst, this is why I'm particularly salty about these so-called moderate Republicans who made the mistake of sticking their heads out of the foxhole they were in after the Mamdani sweep in New York, to stamp their feet and put out a declaration, a promise to America that we're not commies. And these are the usual suspects, guys like Josh Gottheimer of New York, and there's a whole slew of kind of blue dog Democrats. These are mostly backbenchers, but they have access to a lot of money and they have access to the political class. They can always get on the Sunday talk shows. So it's a problem because they are colluding in our minds with the fascists to try to suppress a left that they can't beat at the ballot box. And so I really, you know, this so-called moderate manifesto was so laughable. And it was, I'm glad they did it, because this was there's about a dozen of them in this Problem Solvers Caucus in Congress. And they're always the ones who are selected for the rotating villain part. You know, when capital really doesn't want something, but there's a majority for it, these are the guys that'll throw it. And they're talking about purging us from the party. I'm going to tell you what, the tables ever get turned here, those guys, I better be looking at their membership cards, because that kind of collusion with your ideological, or should be your ideological enemies, your opponents, is that's, you know, you talk about party loyalty. I've got more loyalty to a party that rejects that premise. You know, there's nothing in the Constitution that says that you have to be capitalist to run for Congress. There's other economic systems that you can subscribe to. It's a free country. Anyway, I wanted to play just a little clip here. Majority Report, Sam Cedar and Emma Viglin and the crew are all having a lot of fun with this moderate manifesto. And it was so named by by Mamdani because he, after he got elected, he had one of these kind of passive-aggressive media interviews with this, well, I think his name is Jonathan Carl or something, this ABC Bigfoot journalist who wasn't really happy with him but had to be respectful. and this Carl brought up that this group, the Problem Solvers Caucus, has written a manifesto. And Mamdani says, that sounds kind of socialist to me. And the guy says, oh, no, no, it's a moderate manifesto. So that's stuck. So this is the moderate manifesto. And I present to you the crew of Majority Report having fun with this one.
Wow. Will you go back over that again? Because I think this is the so-called moderates, really the conservative Democratic manifesto can be summed up right here.
And now he wants to continue to serve. In terms of what his big idea is, it's that politics is broken. And maybe we need a solution to it that risks the imagination of a new kind of possibility.
Ooh. Risks the imagination, and you know, that was he is literally reading that off his hand. Risks the imagination of a new kind of possibility.
Man. Do we have a bald eagle sound that we can put out in the background, just so...
I've got goosebumps.
Me too. Me too.
I want that Michigan fist!
That's a manifesto.
Cory Booker's manifesto.
Yeah. So he's a big fan of that kind of. Cory Booker is the poster child for these moderate Democrats. They're not a fan, and neither am I. So they continue where they're comparing the moderate manifesto to the Communist Manifesto, and staff expert Matt Leck, who calls himself a Marxist and is actually very learned about it, weighs in on what the policy prescriptions are in these two manifestos.
But did it risk? Did it risk the imagination of a new kind of possibility?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Risk the imagination of a new kind of possibility.
I think that's exactly what Mark Snagles
did. You need to send me that as a link because I think I'm going to use it as my ringtone.
Why doesn't one reporter go, what the hell do you mean by that?
Because they're...
Yeah. Okay, I think that was. I want to make sure we're good.
Impressed by the PR consultants speak more than they are about the politics like Mondani's.
I can tell you how he would answer today. It means,
cha-ching.
$2.5 million in my bank account.
I'm tired of that campaign.
If you look at my house on the Delaware Bay.
I love, the thing where he's like, yeah, Howard Schultz, he built a great company and did right by it. Like, is that what we all think of Starbucks?
Yeah, no. Right, no. It's interesting, though, how just when Mamdani said, I forget exactly what his phrasing was about Gottheimer and how they're offended by that kind of politics. You know, they're also increasingly deeply worried about being irrelevant. Like, I think we should also just, like, this is existential for a lot of people. It's an existential for consultants who, as I've said,
without a doubt,
are threatened by a DSA-style people power politics because it makes their commission that they get off of TV and digital buys completely.
Yeah, well, it makes them moot, essentially, because they don't get a cut off of a ground game run campaign. And that's one of the real problems that the Democratic Party has to face, is that a lot of these corporate-backed candidates, kind of the post-Clinton era, where Clinton decided, well, if we can't beat him, join him, has really vitiated the party. And I think I'm seeing in races all across the country where people distinguish themselves from their opponent by not taking corporate money or AIPAC money. And that is a big change. Unfortunately, the math of that doesn't work out very well unless you're in a deep blue district that has a lot of highly motivated voters, like, you know, the people who live in the say Brooklyn, who, you know, there is a high concentration of political activists there. But in general, the money wins. And so we're going to have to find ways to, you know, that is essentially what DSA is modeling, is doing ground-based campaigns that don't cost a ton of money. You got to do a little advertising, but you can, you know, you can fundraise that. But you just can't do the saturation bombing that the corporate candidates do, because the money spread is 10 to 1 typically, and that's not going to change, I don't think. But anyway, so he continues on here. And Matt Leck points out that in the Communist Manifesto, there were actually a number of policy prescriptions, things that he said, you know, one of them was a progressive income tax so that wealthier people paid more. But they compare this to the fact that this moderate manifesto has all the hallmarks of the liberal mindset propaganda, which is, I think Obama introduced that. It's vibes-based politics. You use, oftentimes the rhetoric is very stirring, to risk the possibility of a new kind of politics. That sounds pretty cool. But when you get down to the nitty-gritty, they don't present a program. They present a vibe, and we're going to do something about the middle class and yada, yada, yada. And nobody believes it anymore. It's done. It's finished. We're going to have to come up. They're going to have to come up with a better line. And the thing is, they've got opponents who do have a better line. So there's some competition now, and it's good. Continuing on with comparing the moderate manifesto and the Marxist manifesto.
Like Gottheim are increasingly irrelevant. They don't get to call themselves problem solvers when the entirety of the Democratic electorate thinks that centrists can't govern, because they can't. They can't win and they can't govern.
Socialism is not the ism that is a problem with Democratic voters, right?
Yeah,
now.
Yeah.
It's a different ism, one that Gottheimer subscribes to.
And there's a media class, though, that is also tied in, the Dana Bashes of the world, the Morning Joes, that have bought into this style of politics and gotten really rich and have come up in an age where this has benefited them and it's shaped their perspective, that are giving interviews that weight this kind of viewpoint of Gottheimer's and this centrism more than it is reflected in the voting base, which is like 80% of Democrats are like 90% want to cut arms to Israel, 80% say Israel's committing genocide, and that's not reflected in the framing of like the divisiveness of how Democratic Socialists or Zoran Mamdani respond to this issue. They act like it's a completely fringe position within the Democratic electorate. It's not even a fringe position in the general public.
Yeah, and that disconnectedness of this DC-centered political class is ripe for a transformation here. And there's been a debate that went on the left for decades, to the point where I became weary of it, which is, should we start a third party or should we run as Democrats? But we can't be polluted by being a Democrat. And so it never really got anywhere. And so what we're trying to do is create a pragmatic politics, which finds to get people invested in the politics so that after the election, they help you be a constituency that helps you govern. That's the trick. That's what Mamdani and the DSA candidates have introduced. That there are people that can be mobilized 24/7, 365, not just on election years or on campaign seasons. And that's a brand new world for these guys, and I wish them well because they're going to need it. And I can see we got to go to break, so off we go. Back in a bit.
You've been listening to Deconstructing Media with your host, Ben Boyce, sponsored by
Hannah Center's 2026 Summer Camps in Sonoma Valley. They are now accepting registrations. Week-long sessions include traditional camp activities and programs in Lego robotic, creative arts, culinary arts, and other hands-on learning experiences. More information is available at hannacenter.org/camps. That's hannacenter.org/camps.
This health moment is brought to you in part by Sonoma Valley Hospital.
Learning to flip your thoughts can have a profound impact on your health and well-being. The simplest way is through a positive affirmation that flips the thought from a negative to a positive. For example, when faced with chores, instead of saying, "I don't want to clean the house," say, "I like living in a clean house." When getting up the motivation to exercise, instead of saying, "I'm too tired to exercise today," say, "I feel more alert and energetic when I exercise." Positive affirmations help us change our negative attitudes into positive ones.
Entertainment is blooming across Sonoma Valley, and the calendar is filling up fast. From live music and wine tasting to community gatherings, art shows, festivals, and nightlife, there's something happening almost every day and night of the week once the Tuesday night market season kicks into gear. KSVY and Sonoma TV have been hard at work updating the community calendar at SonomaValleyEvents.com to help you discover what's happening around the valley. Need inspiration for your next night out? Looking for live music, local culture, or family-friendly fun? Visit ksvy.org and click Sonoma Valley Events on our website header and let the good times roll.
And now back to Deconstructing Media.
All right, and back for our final segment here with another of my favorite left YouTube commentators, Left Reckoning, which is also has our friend Matt Leck as a co-host, Matt Leck being the producer you hear in the background on Majority Report. And David Griscom, who worked with another former host at Majority Report. So there's kind of a couple degrees of separation for a lot of these people. And the Left Reckoning is particularly focused on developing the progressive movement in the rural parts of this country. David Griscom himself is from Texas. And so it's kind of interesting because Jacobin has paid the two of them to do a weekly show for the magazine. They want to have a podcast that accompanies it. And so it was a very deliberate choice on Bhaskar Sunkar, the editor of Jacobin magazine, to pick two guys who do not sound like effete coastal elites. David Griscom has a Texas twang, and Matt Lex from South Dakota, so he's got this Midwestern accent. So it's a good look for DSA and for Jacobin, because these are not the kind of people that they're expecting to hear from, and they're both very scholarly, very bright. So it opens with an interview that I mentioned earlier with the Jonathan Carl of ABC interviewing newly I think a year in, sorry, at some juncture, he's having this kind of review of his first 100 days. And that's very interesting because Jonathan Carl has this kind of centrist DMC cartoonish vision of what the DSA actually stands for and what it means. They're afraid of it. They don't like it. But they're also realizing it's sort of a reality they're having to deal with. So and we start out with this little interview.
It's a centrist manifesto here because it's pretty good. So let's get back to why Zoran's killing it, then we'll get to these big ideas from the opposition.
Ownership. I mean, this is a direct response, they've made it clear, to what you did here on Tuesday.
Well, I mean, you know, that's great, but what's a party if not its voters? And I'm proud to sit in front of you as the mayor of our city, having received more than 1 million votes little less than a year ago. And when we're talking about these incredible congressional candidates, they won their races, and they won their races with a vision of what politics should be, and one that actually speaks to working people. And for a lot of people who ask themselves, what does democratic socialism mean? And you can tell them the answer at a theoretical level. It's the choice to extend democracy from the ballot box the rest of their lives. But in terms of what it means over these last 7 months, we've seen a city with democratic socialist principles at the heart of it within our administration. And what we've delivered has been record lows when it comes to murders and shootings.
So is it pragmatic democratic socialism?
I think democratic socialism at the heart is pragmatic, because if we cannot deliver for working people, then what is this for? I'm not interested in writing a manifesto or, frankly, in reading one. I'm interested in delivering, and that's exactly what we've been showing.
But
yeah, and so I love how Mamdani is kind of playing with this guy, because in his mind, socialist rule is like having this gang of hoodlums who are marauding through the city. And, you know, it's just at this kind of dystopian hellscape. And it's like, well, I mean, it's not just like they're going to have ideological trials in Central Park. That's what they think. There's going to be, they get out the guillotines for the worst class offenders. No, it's like, no, the buses will run faster and on time, and they'll be free. they'll provide free child care, and they'll have grocery stores with fresh fruit and vegetables, which are sponsored by the city. They're run by city employees. So, I mean, that's what the kind of thing that he's delivering on, as opposed to these fantasies of these ideological purges. I'm sure they're afraid of that, but the ideological purge is going to come at the ballot box. That's where I look at it. So they continue here on this theme of that democratic socialism per se is pragmatic. It's what it's about.
I spoke at one of the Zoran victory parties on election nights, and this was was what I was talking about there. Said, like, we hold the common sense pragmatic position. Our politics are the sensible, reasonable, pragmatic politics, and we should take confidence and enthusiasm in reminding people of that fact. It is actually the people in the center, the people on the right, who are the lunatic fringe. They are the people on the outside of the popular will, and we're seeing that. And again, all this kind of whining that we're seeing from our opponents isn't about representing everyday people. It is about making sure that they don't alienate their donors too much. The good thing, and the reason why Zoran doesn't have to do that, by the way, is because Zoran isn't bought out. Zoran actually has a political movement behind him. That political movement was also the reason that all these other figures won their elections, because they might be able to be outspent, but you will not be able to out ground game them, because there is actual real buy-in from everyday people. So,
yeah, and that is the secret sauce, that there is a committed cadre of people, a nucleus of people who are willing to do political work to not only just around elections, But the kind of more nitty-gritty aspect of actually governing. And one of the points of pride for socialist governance is the quality of the governance. So it's not like it's a place for people to kind of, you know, be in some kind of shuffling around, pushing a broom in some government job. The people who work for Mamdani, he's basically like the CEO of New York, functionally. He knows how to run the ship. And it's important that we have people with those talents and skills, because not everybody has it. And so they continue here.
The advantage that Zoran has, that Claire Valdez has, others have, in addition to like having good politics, is that they actually have a movement that's backing them. And for the Gottheimers and some of these other folks, they don't have that. So the only thing that can keep them in power is the happiness of super wealthy donors, which they're worried might disappear as a more populist and a more people-powered politics take center stage.
Yeah, and you're seeing a lot of cope about this, you know, whether it's... whether it's just about like Mamdani, he's good on social media, we got to get better at that, or it's like the from the Daily Wire crew, like it's all these gentrifying third worldists that are moving into these communities.
I mean, never ends.
Keep doing the psychoanalysis, and socialists are going to keep winning the elections.
Yeah. So Matt Leck is a very confident man there, because he sees what the trajectory is. And unless we're interrupted by some, you know, fascist-run purge, we're going to get there. And the people who run the Democratic Party now have reasons to be concerned. And I think that's a tension I'm willing to carry.
The PTA, the Promise to America. And luckily, it's short and sweet. Like most centrists, is very, very light on details or positions and very, very high on rhetoric. Promise to America. America is stronger than our politics. Politics forces false choices between extremes on right and left. We reject them. Great. Too many Americans have not benefited from the last half century of economic growth. That sounds right. Americans want an economy that lowers costs, expands opportunity, and rewards the people who work hard every day. All right, so a lot of rhetoric here. Here's the promise to America.
Yeah, crap.
Growth, competition, and broad prosperity. We are capitalist, not socialist. We believe in a growing, fair, and competitive economy that rewards hard work, innovation, entrepreneurship, and ownership.
Words there. Sorry to cut in, but four words there. There's hard work. Mm-hmm. And then there's innovate. We're getting already farther away from labor.
Yeah, we're hard, innovation, far from hard work. Well, yeah, the last two.
Entrepreneurship and ownership.
Well, you know, I mean, let me just read this section, because this is a good one. Full-time work should make it possible to own a home, raise a family, afford health care, and retire with dignity. Economic permitting and tax policy should expand opportunity and lower costs for workers, families, entrepreneurs, and those striving to join the middle class, not disproportionately favor those already at the top. Well, I'll tell you, in this first formulation that you have here between people who work hard and owners, that's the problem.
Yeah, and he's just pointing out that the basic dynamic at work in capitalism is that in this class system, there's the wealth is accumulated by the ownership class, and they then decide how much of a cut they can give out in the form of wages. And there's a whole science which has been perfected over a century of American capitalism to minimize and continually diminish the share of income that goes to working people in wages, and to continual increase until at the upper ends of the income scale. It's out of control. It's absurd. It's nominal money. When you start talking about a trillionaire on paper, like Musk briefly did, which I realized now was like a moonshot he did just to flex, because he knew there would be a point at the valuation where his net worth on paper would hit a trillion. And that's just bragging rights among tech bros. they'll all try to get there in some way or another, unless we start deciding instead of increasing our national debt, we might start taxing some of this money back. You know, when they talk about the one platform in the Moderate Manifesto was that we've got to balance the budget and, you know, practice austerity. We've got to pull back. Those guys never once in their equation do they put in the factor, well, actually, if we just returned tax rates to, say, the level they were under John F. Kennedy, for that matter, who reduced them sharply from his predecessors, it would be, we wouldn't have all of this debt, because what is the debt? The government borrows money to cover expenses. Well, what if they just tax that money? Then you don't have to borrow it. Then we don't owe it. Genius. But you will never hear this from the problem solvers. Their one policy solution is basically to put austerity on working people. No, thank you. Those people deserve to lose. They're definitely not going to push us out of the party. They may destroy their own party, but we're here to stay, and eventually we're going to take over, or it's going to be crushed. I mean, that's the bottom line. And I'm good for that. I'm ready for that. And so I will have more interesting and hopefully good news to bring to you this next week on the upcoming edition of Deconstructing Media. Thank you for your time. It's been fun for me, and I hope this has been instructive for you as well. Okay, take care. Bye.
One like this. Train I ride, 16, hold your blow.
Sonoma.
programming for KSVY is brought to you in part by
The Schoen Group, located in beautiful downtown Sonoma. The Schoen Group is affiliated with Sotheby's International Realty. Our goal is to be your realtor, consultants, and representative for many generations to come. For information and guidance regarding Wine Country Real Estate, you may contact us at 707-933-1515 or visit schoengroup.com.
Your voice matters. Hey, Sonoma residents, help redesign the Springs Plaza, located at Boys Boulevard and Highway 12. Supervisor Rebecca Hermosillo invites you to be a part of the planning. Share your ideas, dreams, and whatever you would like to see become of the Springs Plaza. Share your thoughts via email at district1@sonomacounty.gov. Again, that's district1@sonomacounty.gov.